Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. As a part of the Oklahoma Center for the Humanities focus on humor this year, the center will host a program devoted to the incubator of 20th century American entertainment, vaudeville. Vaudeville outside of the theater was the first place where entertainers became celebrities, where later television staples like the sitcom or the variety show had their roots. The center presents the Vaudeville Museum tonight and tomorrow evening, whereby McFarland Library on the University of Tulsa campus transforms into a museum of sorts with live entertainment, where performers bring to life some of the classic vaudeville performers and routines by people like Burt Williams, Sophie Tucker, Fanny Bryce, and Burt Savoy. Visitors will be led around the museum by docents who will give information about the performers and this uniquely American entertainment medium. Joining me today from the Oklahoma Center for Humanities is Michelle Miller-Dill, who's the creator of the Vaudeville Museum and a fellow for the center, and Adrian Alexander, the dean of McFarland Library, who's also on the board of the Center for Humanities and will be participating as a museum docent tonight and tomorrow at McFarland Library. Michelle and Adrian, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you, Rich.
And Dean of the library, Adrian Alexander, you have turned your McFarland Library this Friday and Saturday night into a museum of sorts.
It is being transformed into the Vaudeville Museum.
Where did this idea come from?
Well, where most of my ideas come from, a crazy harebrained idea. The vaudeville notion, there was always going to be a vaudeville show. I applied to be a faculty fellow for the Oklahoma Center for Humanities, and for vaudeville specifically, the theme this year is humor. And I am really interested in how vaudeville was used by immigrants, former slaves, those who were disenfranchised, that stereotypical humor of poking fun at yourself, how that's used and was used to fit into American society. And it really changed American society. So all those light bulb jokes that we all know of, and such as how many actors does it take to change a light bulb? Mm-hmm. It takes 10, one to do it and nine to sit back and say, I could have done that better. All that comes from that assimilation humor. If I'm making fun of myself, you aren't threatened by me. So I can fit in. The Irish did it. Italians did it. Jewish persons did it. To fit into society.
Now, they also had their own cultural theaters, too,
exactly.
At the same time. But eventually, as they assimilated, they began to gravitate towards the vaudeville theaters. Is that right?
Exactly. And there were vaudeville circuits all over the place. In fact, somewhere down around by sort of the Williams Building, 3rd Street, 4th Street in there, I believe was the Rialto.
No, we had a whole bunch of vaudeville theaters, many of which are the cornerstones of the Williams Center.
Yes.
Several of them.
Yes.
But all throughout downtown, yeah. All the movie theaters were vaudeville houses and movie theaters at one point.
Right. And I believe we were part of the Orpheum Circuit, which was the big main circuit of vaudeville houses. There are lots of Orpheum theaters still around, and they're beautiful if you go to a town and see an Orpheum theater. That's part of vaudeville.
So how does this fit into the humor thing with the Oklahoma Center for the Humanities? You're on the board there, Adrian.
I'm a member of the board of directors of the Center for Humanities and have been doing that since the group was founded 2 years ago, and it's been a real pleasure. We've supported a variety of programs that the Center for Humanities has done over the past 2 years, starting with World War I, the first year since we have really significant collections in our own library related to World War I. So we've been heavily involved with all of the center's work. So that sort of naturally led eventually to we've hosted a couple of events before, usually readings and the like. But as Michelle and I started talking through this vaudeville show a while back and trying to envision what her ideas were as far as the various performers will have and how that would work on a stage, we started thinking more and more about a museum concept where the performers would be exhibits, if you will, in different parts of the museum. And then I thought, well, the reading rooms of the original McFarland Library could serve that purpose, and we could simply rotate groups of visitors around among them so everyone would have a chance to see each act. And so we'll actually have docents. I'll be one of the docents, in fact, to take groups of attendees, visitors, by to hear the various performers, and then we can go to the next room and another group comes in behind us to see that act we just...
That's kind of an imaginative format. How did this come about? I mean, were you thinking originally about doing sort of a short vaudeville show?
It was originally going to be about an hour long. Last year, Stephen Marzoff and I put together a World War I show, which is about an hour long. Adrian was in that as well to help support the Center for Humanities. And this year, because of humor, of course, vaudeville, and I wanted it short. And originally it was going to be in Tyrrell Hall that has that beautiful restored theater that's in there. Mm-hmm. But the more I looked at the material I had and the more I started to write and curate and put together this thing, I realized this isn't something that just you put up on a stage and people sit calmly and watch. This is site-specific, interactive, immersive kind of theater. And that I wanted somebody to feel like they went back in time just a little bit and they really spoke to these people. You're going to see the acts that these folks are famous for, Fanny Bryce, Sophie Tucker, Burt Williams, Burt Savoy. You're going to see their acts that they're famous for, but they're going to tell you a little bit of their story. And then the docents will tell you the facts and figures. So you'll get that museum experience, you know, when you go to, say, Crystal Bridges or the Philbrook or the Gilcrease, and you see a painting on the wall and it has the name of the painting, the artist, and a little bit of information about it. You're going to get that, but in a theatrical form. And then you go in and you're entertained and hopefully educated a little bit. But I realized this was not something on a proscenium stage. This was something that needed a very specific spot. And I turned to Adrian and I said, so could I take over your library? And to his credit, he saw the vision and has graciously allowed us to come in and do this.
So you're using the two main reading rooms, or are there, I guess there's two on each floor.
There'll be two on each floor, the two reading rooms that are on the ground floor, one of which, the south room, is now the Pat and Arnold Brown reading room. And then upstairs, the Jack and Ann Graves faculty study on the south side. And then directly across from it is the what we call the student study now. Students often refer to it as the Harry Potter room. But but they set up great. They're very large and spacious. We have furniture in there, obviously, which we can move around to some extent. But the acoustics in every one of those rooms are great, especially since we remodeled a few years back and we added very heavy drapes to those stained glass windows. It really provides a nice tight space, so you can actually perform and do readings and things, which we have done without any kind of audio enhancement, and be heard pretty effectively.
Now, as you began researching this vaudeville project, certainly you could have done all sorts of numbers, and certainly a lot of the old situations of vaudeville are still with us today in TV sitcoms. And I mean, really, when you learn about vaudeville, you're learning about what's going on today still.
Right. And actually, in the faculty fellow seminar, I had to present on this topic. And I showed some modern vaudeville, Bill Irwin, and there are lots of forms of modern vaudeville out there today that we don't really recognize as modern vaudeville. But to curate this down to four people, confession time, I teach this in my musical theater history lit class, and Ziegfeld Follies and vaudeville happens to be one of my favorite time periods. And yes, I do have the Ziegfeld Follies paper dolls and the vaudeville paper dolls to show the students what the costumes look like, because they were amazing. But I curated it down to the four people I thought were most impactful. I'm sure it's arguably that, but these are four of my favorites.
There are four headliners, but you have to remember the way vaudeville worked was they were headliners, but they were also interstitial, because they would go on, do their bit, and then all of a sudden it's the chorus girls with the big, huge costumes and the big, showy production numbers. And then it would be a comedian, and then it would be a juggler, and then it would be another big production number. So it was this sort of continual cycle of hit them and hit them quick, and then you're on to the next one.
And vaudeville had a very distinct formula. You started off with a dog act or a dance act. There was no dialogue in it, and that was for folks who came in late. And then you had a terpsichorean act, a fancy dancing act. You might have had a couple of more numbers in there, a short play. Like Irving Berlin wrote things for this. Famous playwrights and authors wrote things for Broadway. You would have, at the end of Act One, a rising star or a falling star to perform. Then you had intermission, and you came back and had, like, your big number, and then your headliner for the evening would perform, and then you had another bad act so that people could leave. And so,
And the bad act was important, so you – turned over the crowd so you could do the next show.
Exactly, because there were several shows a day. My favorite acts didn't make it into this because that's the reason it's the museum. You're seeing very specific acts as opposed to a vaudeville show. But my favorite acts are things like The Regurgitator or Yes. Yeah, just look it up on YouTube and don't blame me if you do. And the weird acts, the odd acts, the really fun acts that we look at today and go, did somebody really do that? You know,
the guy who could do an aria by flapping his arm with his hand under his arm.
Exactly.
And people paid money to see that,
yes,
too.
Yes, and loved it. Or the Cherry Sisters, who were known as the worst vaudeville act in history.
And yet they got booked.
They got booked a lot.
As a way to clear the house.
Yes.
So they could
sell
tickets.
And they collected a lot of vegetables while they were up there. Yeah, there's stories about the Cherry Sisters.
Well, you chose four really legendary performers of vaudeville. Let's talk about your Fanny Bryce. So you're going to do Fanny Bryce songs.
I'm playing Fanny Bryce.
Now, I always think of Fanny Bryce as a singer, but was she as much a singer as she was a...
She started off as a dancer, actually.
A dancer. Mm-hmm. She sang a little bit, but it was comedy.
She was known for her Baby Snooks character later on, after sort of post vaudeville. Mm-hmm. But during vaudeville, she spoke with a really heavy Yiddish dialect, which she didn't speak at all. She adopted that, and you'll learn if you come see the show. You'll learn about that. But she adopted that because it was the only way people would take her seriously. If she did her comedy with a thick Yiddish accent, one of the songs I'm doing is called Sadie Salome. And it's Sadie Chon left a happy home. You know, so there's a lot of spit flying up there.
Right.
And that was all part of her shtick, was that she played into the Jewishness, the Yiddishness of her character. And there were lots of conflicts with the Jewish immigrants assimilating into culture at that time. And so she had to appear to fit in. And that was one of the ways that she poked fun at herself to fit in.
Yeah. Now, a couple of names that might not be that familiar. Certainly one is very familiar to people who understand vaudeville, and that's Burt Williams.
If you know anything about vaudeville, hopefully you do know about Burt Williams. He was from Nassau, Bahamas. He was African Bahamian, I guess would be the appropriate terminology for that. He started life as a civil engineering major, and his family ran out of money, and the only way he could make money was to go on the vaudeville circuit. So Williams and Walker, it was a popular duo back in the day, and then he soloed after that and became the top performer in vaudeville.
Didn't he have to perform in blackface, though, didn't he?
He had to perform in blackface, and Nash McQuarters is playing Burt. He is not going to be performing in blackface, but we have made a nod to that. That's just offensive. So we decided but to make the point.
And really, he's really a tragic person. He couldn't be black and be on the stage. He had to be in blackface to masquerade as a white as a black.
That's absolutely.
It's a very tragic story, really.
And in fact, and this point is brought up in the show, one of the sad facts is he was allowed, I put air quotes around the word, allowed to stay in the same hotel as the white performers, which that was unheard of at that point in time. But he had to ride the service elevator to get to his room. And he wrote about it, about how much that hurt. And he said, the quote is, you know, it wouldn't hurt so much if the applause wasn't still ringing in my ears. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it really gives you a gut punch.
Now, the other two performers, one may not be that familiar, Burt Savoy.
Burt Savoy is my favorite, and that's why he's on here. He is a drag queen, goes by the name of Maud. Maud and Jay Brennan was his partner in life and his partner on the stage. Burt Savoy is responsible for all of Mae West's shtick. His phrase was, well, you must come over sometime. And she, of course, turned that into, you must come up sometime and see me. And he would also say, you don't know the half of it, dearie. And Mae sort of co-opted his whole look and all of his shtick.
Now, was the whole point of the shtick, I mean, when we think of a drag queen, we think of 50s and 60s and later, you know.
Right.
I'm assuming it was like it had to be done so broadly that audiences would get it or wouldn't be offended or what, you know.
If you look at the jokes back in the day, it's the same, a lot of the same shtick that you see nowadays. It's a little bit more clean.
yeah.
than what we see nowadays.
But the double entendre was still
there. You know, they didn't do the snap, you know, like, oh, girl, and,
yeah, right.
and the snap that we think of. But everything else. And during this time period, one thing that I, doing research that I just loved, there were traveling troops of former doughboy soldiers who went around the country dressed in drag and performed.
Hmm.
It really didn't have much to do with whether they were homosexual or whether they weren't. It was performance. Bert Savoy was homosexual. I don't want to sanitize that. I don't want to take that away from him. He was, and he was out as much as he could be for the time period, 20s, early 20s. He died in 23. But he was as out as he could be in that time period. People knew about it, and he was one of the most famous drag queens around. And like I said, he trained Mae West.
Yeah, and it sounds like it was a very funny act.
Oh, I have to share this. It's sort of the punchline of the show, but I've told this story so many times it's not going to hurt. His death probably is the biggest thing about Bert Savoy. He was walking along the boardwalk on Long Island Beach, and there was a thunderstorm out to sea, and this huge clap of thunder came along, and he stopped and he said, "Why, ain't that Miss God cutting up something awful?" And a bolt of lightning came and struck him dead. True story. I've verified the story.
My guests today are Michelle Miller Dill, who is the creator of the Vaudeville Museum. Adrian Alexander is the dean of the library, which will transform the McFarland Library at TU, will transform into the Vaudeville Museum tonight and tomorrow evening at 7 o'clock. This is a free performance featuring these about 15, 20 minutes of... So I guess you had to look at all the routines and figure out what the best routines would be for something like this.
I will tell you, and I'm going to throw this over to Adrian, the very first routine that was brought to my attention is one that Dean Alexander is going to favor us with during the show.
I said to Michelle when she had been selected as a fellow, and I sent my congratulatory email to her, I said, if you ever come up with a show that has room for Who's On First... Deal me in. So
you're going to be doing Who's
we'll
On
be,
First?
Yes.
Abbott
and yes,
Costello.
We'll be doing the classic Who's On First routine and as part of the show.
Now, you're also serving as a museum docent of sorts.
I'm a docent, so, and I'll be taking people around. And at some point in the show, things will happen, and suddenly vaudeville comedy will just break out spontaneously. And folks who have almost everybody, if you look on YouTube, there are any number of the different renditions of the routine, which actually predates Abbott and Costello, but they certainly made it most famous. But there are any number of variations of what they did with it, and it still amazes me to this day to listen to it because they could do it in such a rapid-fire fashion. It was just ingrained. It was hardwired into their brains, you know, by the time they reached a certain age.
Yeah, even I'm sure rehearsing it, it probably takes a great deal of repetition to get the speed
up. It's a really challenging piece to get down because there's so many of the lines are just yes and that's it and who and repeating who's on first
and it has to have a rhythm.
Yes, it's got to have a rhythm. You can't break that rhythm or you'll throw your partner off. And so while it doesn't seem like that many words to learn, it's the repetition, it's the order, it's getting the timing down that's the real challenge to it. So
now all of your museum docents, are they going to be doing something along with sort of guiding the various groups around through the museum?
They really are the information givers, but each one has a very distinct personality. Adrian is the suave intellectual. And that's how he's guiding people through. And you have the most amount of lines. I think I was counting up. And then Charles Kevin Smith is also guiding folks through for people who are familiar with theater pops. And he is the bookish one. And he actually knows a lot about vaudeville. When I ask him to do this, he goes, "Oh, I have several albums of vaudeville routines." And I went, "Of course you do. Of course you do." And then Lisa Cole is our sexy blonde hostess who will be taking people through as Lisa, the docent, throughout. We also have playing Bert Savoy is Pat Hobbs, and playing Jay Brennan is John Orsalak. And then the incomparable Rebecca Ungerman is also the incomparable Sophie Tucker.
Yeah, and Sophie Tucker, that's, again, people know her probably more from Bette Midler's version of Sophie Tucker. But Sophie Tucker is just this incredible larger-than-life character.
Absolutely. And who better than Rebecca Ungerman to play that particular character? And I can't tell you any of the jokes that Sophie will do. All I can say is, what's the matter, Soph? Ain't you got a vase? So you'll have to come and hear the rest of the joke.
Yeah, it's a little PG-rated, I suppose.
Yes.
Now, I understand you have a few surprises as well that will happen through this curatorial tour, right?
Well, it's site-specific. There's always bound to be a surprise, but hopefully they're curated surprises. We have an impresario who will be going through and doing improv. That's Ed Dill. You might recognize the last name. Mm-hmm. But he'll be going through and doing some improv in each one of the rooms. We have a roving Irish girl who's trying to break into show business, Liz Hunt, who will be doing that. And did I leave anybody out? David Blakely, bless his heart, has come along for the ride and allowed me to convince him to play the accordion.
He's actually
the other half in my room, and he's taken some of the heavy lifting off my shoulders. But we have an accordion. Jim Gregory is the music director. He's playing the piano. And then Josh Westbrook is playing both banjo and guitar for it. So each room will have its own distinct vaudevillian sound.
Now, it sounds like it starts at 7 o'clock, but are the tours staggered, or are you going to various rooms at all the same time? Are we going to meet in the corridors and that sort of thing?
That's why we'll have three docents, so we can take groups in different directions. So one will start with Sophie Tucker, another with Fanny Bryce, and so forth. Mm-hmm. And then we'll alternate. And Michelle has spent many hours working out the rotation just right, so we never intersect or end up in the same place until very end.
And I assume on tonight's performance, you're going to have a talk back afterwards.
Yes. There's a reception and a talk back. And so anyone who wants to get more information, there's a multimedia, not a presentation, but a video that's going to be playing in the room that has the reception with more information about vaudeville. But anybody who wants firsthand accounts or some more just, you know, of the research or how it was to do this, it's been interesting working with Nash on Burt Williams, because we can't do most of what Burt was known for, most of his funny stuff. It's highly offensive, and it's truly awful. But we want to present this man's story because he was so pivotal in the context of vaudeville. And so I think Nash has a very interesting perspective as a modern day person portraying somebody who was so famous yet so discriminated against.
Well, and also his material itself was self-loathing too.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
No, it's a tragic story about
him.
Well, I hope a lot of people come out to the Vaudeville Museum. It's free. You can't beat that price at 7 o'clock tonight and tomorrow evening. And sounds like there'll be some surprises as well. And before we go, Adrian, I know this is part of a whole series of presentations on humor from the Oklahoma Center for Humanities. What are some of the other things that are coming up through the rest of the year?
We just had a poetry event.
Right.
There is going to be, in the spring, we're going to have a celebration of the Big Lebowski. That's going to be quite exciting. There's some
surprises,
big things
I
going
hear.
On, some very fun surprises related to that.
All right.
I think there'll be a screening of the film down on the Guthrie Green as part of that, and I hope we all go bowling at the Dust Bowl at some point.
Yeah, it should be good.
I would like to get up a group to go do that. So. And I'll add that Professor Sean Latham, who is the director of the center, will be on hand at our event, and he'll be roving around. So perhaps at the reception, if people want to find out more about the Oklahoma Center for Humanities and what we've got planned, Sean should be available.
All right. The Vaudeville Museum takes place tonight and tomorrow at McFarland Library. It gets underway at 7 o'clock tonight. Michelle and Adrian, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Michelle Miller Dill is a fellow with the Oklahoma Center for Humanities. Adrian Alexander is a member of the board and dean of the McFarland Library. Michelle Miller Dill, the creator of the Vaudeville Museum, which takes place tonight at McFarland Library at 7 o'clock with an additional performance tomorrow evening at 7. There'll be a talk back and reception after tonight's performance, and both are free and open to the public. You're listening to Studio Tulsa. Here's the comments of Janet Pearson.
Some listeners will remember Sigmund Freud's famous analogy comparing humans with hedgehogs in the wintertime. Being social animals, the hedgehogs try huddling closely together in the winter to keep from freezing to death. But because of those needle-sharp spines, they also must take care not to huddle too closely together. Luckily, we humans, also social animals, don't have to worry about anything like that. Or do we? Freud seemed to think so, And another expert in the field of human behavior believes the hedgehog's plight is exactly what's behind the bane of the human workplace, office politics. We might not have all that much in common with hedgehogs, but all group members do have this in common. We must learn cooperation in order to survive, and at the same time deal with competition that can be toxic. What's a hedgehog to do? I've heard all my working life that office politics is just a fact of life in the workplace. More and more research suggests that's so. A recent Harvard Business Review article called Office Politics an Inevitable Force of Nature. Why, I wondered, is that so? The author explains, citing the work of psychologist Robert Hogan on the universal dynamics of workplace relationships. Three basic evolutionary needs, what he called master motives, are at work. First, there's the need to get along, which enables group living animals to not only survive, but even to thrive. Next, there's the need to get ahead. In any group, some individuals will be willing to take on leadership roles, but eventually their power will be challenged by others in the group. The result? Well, you know, competition, friction, backstabbing, etc. At the same time, some group members will strive to be accepted and loved by the leaders, which will result in group members climbing on top of each other to achieve that aim. The third master motive group members are driven by is the desire to find meaning. I'm not sure what meaning hedgehogs might be searching for. Maybe something as simple as a reliably warm spot in the family den. But I suppose even hedgehogs need an organizational structure which provides them with the lens they require to make sense of their world. Since it seems our brains are hardwired from eons of evolution to behave the way we do, in the workplace as well as every place else, is there any hope that office politics can be eradicated or at least effectively managed? An endless succession of experts and consultants would have us believe that it can be controlled to some degree, and maybe they're right. It's certainly worth trying, because office politics is behind most discontent in the workplace and is a major reason people leave their jobs. The problem may be worse than most suspect. A recent Gallup survey found that only 30% of American workers are engaged with their jobs. The other 70% are just going through the motions and may even be undermining their workplaces by causing a wide variety of problems and hindering productivity. But I, for one, am convinced office politics is here to stay. Some aspects of human behavior may be subject to being controlled or changed, but looking out for yourself when a threat is perceived isn't one of them. Does anyone really think a hedgehog would be willing to give up those spines?
Janet Pearson is a former longtime op-ed writer for the Tulsa World and now a regular contributor to Studio Tulsa. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.
The University of Tulsa welcomes the Greater Tulsa community to a wide array of athletic events, artistic performances, exhibitions, academic lectures, and symposia held on campus. Our public events are open to all. Requests for accommodation of disabilities may be directed to Dr. Tawny Taylor at 918-631-2315. To ensure availability of an interpreter, 5 to 7 days' notice is needed. 48 hours is recommended for all other accommodations.